In the attic? Dumb and dumber. One evening, we decided it was time for a break in homework and a well-earned smoke, but much to our surprise and horror, the loose floorboard was nailed shut. Nothing was ever said or needed to be said, and we never smoked cigarettes again. Monsignor John F. Bennett, Huntington, New York, pastor. Son of John J. Bennett, postal employee, 1904 to 1974.
The Enforcer. Talk about tough love, and not a word spoken.
In 1972, I was living with my parents in Southern California, where our property included a house, a dairy barn, and several other small buildings. My sister and I were expected to utilize covered parking that was some distance from the house. Although I knew Dad's expectation, I continued to park my car in the shade of a peach tree near the house. One morning, a couple of hours after Dad had left for work, I came out to hop in my little white bug to drive to classes. I noticed that the driver's side window had been rolled down and that the biggest, thickest chain I had ever seen was connected to a huge padlock. It snaked around the trunk of the peach tree and through the window, effectively neutering my steering wheel and rendering the vehicle inoperable. I jumped on my bike and rode 45 miles, round trip, to make my classes that day, steaming all the way. When I got home, the chain was still there. Dad didn't say a word about it, and neither did I. The next morning, it was gone. And you can bet I parked in the right spot from that day on. Mitchell C. Thomas, Reno, Nevada, marriage and family therapist, son of Roy F. Thomas, building contractor, 1919.
The envelope. I must have received at least 20 letters describing this type of enforced savings plan.
In the summer of 1968, I had just graduated from high school in Brooklyn and was eagerly awaiting the start of my college career at Brooklyn College in September. I got a summer job doing clerical work at a shipping company and made $60 a week before taxes. When I told my father about the job, he was excited for me and added that he wanted me to contribute $15 a week for household expenses. I was angry at him for asking me to give up some of my hard-earned money, but I complied with his request every week. The week before I started college, he handed me a large envelope that contained all the money I had given him over the summer. "I wasn't interested in your money," he told me. "I just wanted to teach you a little responsibility." And he did. Ira Gershansky, Staten Island, New York, psychologist, son of Joseph Gershansky, bus maintainer, 1914 to 1979.
The Engineer. At work, Dad created robots. At home, he invented punishments. He seems to have been successful in both places.
I had a dad who read to me when Mom was too tired to think, a dad who knew when he walked in the door after a long day at work that Mom had had a tougher day at home, feeding and raising 12 children. I had a dad who sacrificed so all of his children could attend Catholic schools. On Saturday nights, he used to line up our polished shoes so they would be ready for church on Sunday. He taught us by example. He came home from work every day, treated our mother with respect, and mopped the floors on his hands and knees. This is the same man who made a robot that went to the moon and who, in 1966, invented a surgical stapler that is used all over the world. Sometimes he would show home movies. We'd be watching a birthday party on the screen, and suddenly the scene would switch to an operating room. A dog was being operated on, and the surgeon would use Dad's staple gun rather than stitches to suture the poor animal. Then the scene would switch back to our family. Dad didn't bring much attention to himself, just to the object and its purpose. Mom used to say that he could have achieved even more in his career, but he didn't want to uproot his family. His creativity extended to punishments, too. If you acted up, as we all did at times, You had to crack walnuts. Dad would buy them in 100-pound bags. If you misbehaved in church, you had to kneel for 45 minutes on our gravel driveway. When my oldest brother was fascinated with matches, Dad had him stand outside with a book of matches and light each one, holding it until it burned as far down as he could stand. If two of us were fighting, we had to stand in the kitchen, each in a separate square on the tile floor, far enough apart so we couldn't reach each other, and think of three nice things about the other person. I use this form of discipline with my own kids. The greatest legacy that Dad will leave behind is that his children get along so well as adults. With all the sibling rivalry that existed as we were growing up, we still manage to get together often during the year, and we actually like one another. Dad taught us to care. In the long run, what more can a father do? Jean Moran, teacher, Aledo, Illinois, daughter of Joseph Slowick, mechanical engineer, 1922.
The Survivor.
Pray to God, but row for shore. John F. Desmond, father of Mary Pinkawish.
While serving in England during World War II, my dad was in a terrible plane crash that put him in the hospital for 6 months with bad burns and a broken jaw. Other men, of course, were even less fortunate. Many didn't return at all. And of those who did, some came home with disfigurements, missing limbs, or severe emotional problems. Stan Barza, who lived three doors from us, had been a sergeant in the U.S. Army's 76th Infantry Division. After he was wounded in Germany, his leg was amputated 6 inches below the knee. He walked with a limp, and as his neighbors, we saw another grim reminder of his injury. Every family hung its wash on the line, and the Barza's laundry included a woolen stump sock, a very long sock that went over what remained of Stan Barza's left leg. Mr. Barza worked as a tool and die inspector and studied to be an optician, but he refused to let his disability limit him. Like many dads in our neighborhood, he was always working on or around the house, shoveling the driveway, climbing a ladder to put up the storm windows, or cleaning out the gutters. He was also our Boy Scout troop leader, and we were a rowdy bunch. As far as we knew, he never complained. The only concession he ever made, his son Fran told me recently, was that he wouldn't put on a bathing suit. We grew up thinking that every dad had an artificial leg, Fran added, and I learned from some of the letters that this was true in other families as well. We knew that Mr. Barza had a disability, but we didn't think of him as disabled or as someone to feel sorry for. Some dads carry the burden of war wounds. Others are weighed down by alcoholism, cancer, heart disease, or other infirmities. Brad Reardon's father needed a new liver, and his son's account of how he provided it appears in this chapter. Around the time Reardon's letter came in, I heard from a colleague of Kate Drohan, the woman's softball coach at Northwestern University, and of Kate's identical twin sister, Carol, the associate head coach. Back in 1984, their father John, a retired New York fireman, underwent a heart transplant. At the time, John knew that he had only a 50% chance of seeing his twin daughters reach their teenage years. Actually, Kate told me in a letter, he didn't live to watch his kids grow up, he lived to help his kids grow up. In September 2004, John Drohan needed a second transplant, a kidney this time, because of the side effects of the drugs he had been taking ever since his heart transplant. The waiting list for a cadaver donor was 2 years, but John didn't have that long. There were plenty of volunteers within the family who were willing to donate a kidney, including John's two sons, but they didn't match. Kate and Carol both did. Each daughter wanted to be the one to donate a kidney, and they argued about it for days. The skills of compromise that they had developed over 30 years did not apply here. Although they listened to each other's questions such as, how would the person feel who didn't do it, or what if something happened to one of us, neither twin would give in. Through it all, their primary concern was, what if it didn't work? Finally, unable to decide, they asked a friend to flip a coin, which was how this unusual honor fell to Kate. After the operation, Carol told her sister that despite everything their dad had just been through, all he seemed to care about was that Kate was all right. When they were reunited in the recovery room, he embraced his daughter and said, "What's the matter? You look a little tired." That, says Kate, was his way of saying thanks. Kate's surgery took 3 hours and left her with a 5-inch scar on her stomach. But she doesn't have to stay on any medicine, and she was told her life expectancy was not affected. "Of course, that sounds funny to me," she says, "because I know from my father that my scientific life expectancy is probably not accurate anyway. Besides, I suspect Dad would have you know that it's more important to be concerned about your life's impact than its length. I have never met John Drohan, but he must be a hell of a father." The Ride. Sometimes a dying dad will hang on if there's something to live for, and there was, and he did.
My father was a first-generation Italian-American, and I was his only son. All my sisters had married and given him grandchildren, and he was as content as he could be, considering that his dear Gracie, my mother, had been dead 5 years. He seemed resigned to the fact that having hit 40, I would probably never marry and give him a grandchild. Then I met a lovely woman, and after a short time we were married. Within months, Pop was diagnosed with metastatic liver and lung cancer. Upon hearing the news that he had less than a year, he bravely said that he wasn't afraid to die. Then Marie and I found out that we were expecting. I went to tell Pop, but when I got to his house, he was sleeping, knocked out from the chemotherapy. I sat and waited, but he soon awoke and sensed that something was up. When I told him the news, he sat up and said, "I'm gonna make that." It wasn't easy. He was taking chemo through his chest from a portable machine. Some days when I'd phone him, he would just whisper, "Bad day," and hang up. On the day our daughter was born, as soon as my wife and child were safely tucked in at the maternity ward, I drove to tell Dad. His eyes opened from a deep sleep. He smiled and said, "Tell me." When I did, he sat up and clapped as hard as he could. Before he drifted off, I managed to say that my new family would visit as soon as possible. Early the next morning, the phone rang in my wife's hospital room. My sister Teresa said that she and Pop were on their way. I tried to tell her that the long ride would be a torment for Pop, but she said he was already in the car and wouldn't get out until he reached the hospital. An hour and a half later, they arrived. When I opened his car door, Pop woke up and said, "Let's go see our little doll." Dad's legs were really weak from the trip, so I got him a wheelchair and up we went. When he got to Marie's room, Dad asked me to bring the baby to him, saying that he couldn't hold her because his arms were too tired. He told me to put her up near his face, then he leaned over, kissed her, and said, "Sheila Mary, Grandpa loves you very much." Teresa took a picture of my daughter, me, and Dad, the only picture that exists of my dad with any of my children. Within seconds, Pop was asleep. He woke up as we were helping him into the car. I told him how sorry I was that he had to go through so much, including over 3 hours in a car, for a 10-minute visit. He smiled. "Danny, if it was only a minute, it was worth it." As they drove away, I cried uncontrollable tears of joy. Dad's days after that were not many. My sister Olympia said Pop knew his work was done. We were all on our way with our own families. My daughters often ask me to tell them the story of Mommy in the hospital and Grandpa's great gift of unconditional love. In time, we have come to understand the fruits of this gift, how to be life-giving even when you're drained of physical energy, the dignity of spirit in accepting your limitations, giving affection, which can be as simple as putting your lips on a baby's cheek, and grace in the words that Pop shared with his son, who was watching one life end as another was beginning. Dan Mazzio, Bridgehampton, New York, home health aide, son of John Mazzio, auto mechanic, 1924 to 1994.
The dinner. When he wasn't drinking. How much hope and fear is squeezed into those four words.
We had our moments, my father and I. He was an alcoholic who somehow never missed a day's work at Bethlehem Steel in Sparrows Point, Maryland. When I was growing up, I thought everyone's father worked down the point. When he wasn't drinking, he was a good man, intelligent, compassionate, and witty. When he drank, he was dark and abusive. I frequently awoke to loud arguments, dishes being smashed against the wall, my mother screaming in the dead of night. I lay in bed, a skinny little girl paralyzed with fear. There were separations over the years, but she always took him back. There were bad, bad memories, to be sure. But then there was that Christmas. It was 1966. I was 16 and a junior in high school. The steel plant had had a major layoff. Dad was out of work, and we were out of money. My father was sober and had been for several days, but a thick tension hovered over us, and I waited all day for the explosion. We sat down to eat around 5 o'clock, just the three of us, as I was an only child. Things were so bad, we were having scrambled eggs for Christmas dinner. In my mind's eye, I could envision those eggs eventually ending up on the wall. As I pulled my chair closer to the table, my father stood up. In the silence, he looked at my mother for what seemed an eternity. Then he picked up a carving knife and a fork, leaned over the eggs, and with a perfectly serious face, looked at me and asked, "Would you like a breast or a thigh?" I responded, "A thigh, please, and some of that delicious dressing." Just like that, in a magical moment, he had diffused the tension. This man who had so many faces, who could rip the phone out of the wall because I was talking too long, but who might wake up early the next morning so he could polish my shoes for church. This man who would strike my mother one night, but the next afternoon take all the money he had been saving up to buy himself an air conditioner and come back instead with an engagement ring to replace the one she had lost. This man had turned a corner. It was the richest Christmas of my life. He died the following year. Patricia May, retired teacher, Baltimore, Maryland, daughter of Oliver Terry Terrio, steelworker, 1923 to 1967.
The Bachelor's Father. I can't help but wonder, how many of those women did he meet before he made his decision?
Losing doesn't build character, it reveals it. Although my father's life has taken many turns, the word loser seems to have followed him around. He grew up in the Depression-era Bronx with little money. He had a famous older brother, Dolph Shays, who was one of the 50 greatest NBA players, but he wasn't able to equal his brother's success. My father was drafted into the Army during the time he planned to try out for the NBA. He played for the Washington Generals, who were known overseas as the Texas Cowboys, the main foils of the Harlem Globetrotters, which meant losing over 2,000 games without a single victory. Later, he managed bowling alleys and drugstores to provide for his family, and finally, at 70, he started caring for patients who had been branded as losers. He used to tell me that losing 2,000 games did not make him a loser. He refused to be defined by what a scoreboard said. My father was a survivor, not a loser. He worked hard, 6 days a week, to provide for his family. I call him a hero. At my bar mitzvah, I told my dad he was my best friend and would be my best man at my wedding. As time went by, I didn't find anyone to marry, and I forgot my promise to Dad. 23 years went by, and I finally met somebody in 2001 by holding up a sign in Hebrew at the Maccabiah Games in Israel, Single American Man Seeking Israeli Wife. Contact Todd Shays at the Tel Aviv Hilton. Over 6,000 women responded, and one of them became my wife. And I remembered my promise. I called Dad, told him I was getting married, and asked if he would be my best man. There was no answer on the other end of the line. My mom finally came on the phone and said, "Your father is in the other room, crying." Todd Shays, Greenwood Village, Colorado, teacher, basketball coach, son of Herman Shays, hospital aide, 1933.
The gift. Talk about giving of yourself.
This is the phone call I hoped would never come. My stepmother's voice shudders through tears to tell me something is wrong. It is nearly impossible to make out what she is saying, but it must be about my father. For a minute, I believe he is dead, and I fall to the floor of my apartment. I'm not ready for this. After calming down a bit, she says he is now in stable condition. The night before, his temperature had soared to 104 degrees, and he was rushed to the emergency room. We all knew that a night like this was inevitable. It had been almost a decade since he was told he would need a liver transplant. When he was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis in his late 20s, his doctor prescribed the steroid prednisone. But the dosage was not monitored closely enough, and the drug did irreparable damage to his liver. A few months after that night at the hospital, he was placed on a transplant list for a cadaver liver, one of thousands waiting for a stranger's death to give them new life. While he tried to convince me that this was the best solution, my own research showed most people don't survive the wait. I also learned about live liver donation. After some long conversations, my father realized that I would never relent until he agreed to let me give him half of my liver. He had lost his father to heart disease when he was 5, and his mother to cancer when he was 20. His parents had died young, and he had been powerless to help them. But I had a unique opportunity to do more than sit helplessly at his bedside. For our family, the operation was 12 hours of agony. The doctors found a blood clot in the portal vein leading to his liver, which nearly doubled the surgery time and required a major blood transfusion. Had they found the clot before starting the surgery, the procedure would have been canceled permanently. The following spring, my father was at my graduation. 2 years after that, he was dancing at my wedding. It has been nearly 5 years since the surgery, and we both feel great, although his days of beating me at HORSE have long since passed. He gave me the gift of life, and 23 years later, I was able to give it back. Brad Reardon, Seattle, Washington, writer, son of Tim Reardon, attorney, 1948.
The Sculptor. He could have been a victim, but he made a different choice.
He wasn't a hero. He was simply a hard-working, dedicated, and loving father. He had already given us the greatest gift a father can give his children, the unlimited love of our mother. He worked 2 jobs to feed the family and get us through our non-negotiable education. Then, in the spring of 1963, he was shot through the head by juvenile thugs, leaving him blind. Until that evening, my mother's full-time job had been raising her boys. Our full-time job was getting the best grades we could, so we could become professionals. In his blindness, we now judged my father differently. Suddenly, he was a hero. He announced almost immediately that he was inconvenienced rather than handicapped. Depression can be contagious, and he was determined to restrict his worst feelings to his private moments. In public, he fell back on his Myron Cohen-like sense of humor, which was pretty good. In his youth, he had worked in the Catskills as a singer and comedian, but now his repertoire included some funny stories about his blindness. When people asked him, as they often did, "Sam, is it true that when you lose your sight, your other senses improve?" Our dad would always answer the question with a hand cupped over his ear and a loud, "What?" He just made people feel comfortable. He loved to tell the neighbors that his two college sons had given him a color TV for their parents' 40th anniversary, when we had actually given him a Braille watch and our mother the TV. The neighbors believed him, and we played along. At family events, he always brought the house down by singing Sunrise, Sunset, followed by Because of You, dedicated to our mother, with a curtain call of My Way. He taught us to laugh at ourselves, live in the present, and express our love both verbally and with hugs. My brother and I never let a day go by without calling, not just to check in, but because we enjoyed every conversation. Our wives loved him as if he were their own father, and in our marriages we have emulated his complete devotion and love. He became a stone sculptor, using only touch and imagination, and even sold a few pieces. He learned how to package photographic paper in an environment of total darkness, and he was always faster than the sighted employees. He learned to take the subway to Manhattan and was the star at the vacation camp for the blind for 2 weeks each summer, where he organized a diving contest with blind judges. But that's a whole other story. My brother and I have never lived more than a mile apart, another testament to his teaching of family values. Our father is gone now, and we miss speaking to him every day. He was like vitamins for the spirit. Alan Wasserstein, Morganville, New Jersey, marketing executive. Son of Sam Wasserstein, garment worker, 1913 to 1978.
The disability. We've all heard about the man who was sad because he had no shoes, until he met a man who had no feet. It's hard not to think about that line when you read this.
When I was 7, I was sitting at our kitchen table, asking my father how I could be born with 2 legs if he only had one. "I was born with 2 legs too," he replied, "but an accident took one away." His voice was clear and gentle, but he didn't elaborate. My mother was quiet. My younger sister, Nancy, swayed her head back and forth in wide-eyed observation. It was said, and it was accepted. In 1944, Ed D'Amico went off to war and lost his right leg. The accident occurred in the pit of a gun mount aboard the USS St. Paul during an unscheduled exercise of the weapon. I was in my late teens before he really talked about it, maybe because that was a more appropriate age to begin to understand such a loss. Or perhaps it was because Dad's lost limb was almost irrelevant. His attitude never betrayed his eternal optimism and zest for life. After the accident, he was hospitalized at naval facilities in Hawaii, Oakland, and Philadelphia for recovery and rehabilitation. He looked around him for months and saw many young men with no legs or no arms, and men with no limbs at all. He felt lucky. He went home after a year and turned his entire disability pay over to his parents for 6 years, helping them support his 9 siblings until he married my mother. Ed D'Amico was a doer. Actions fueled his dreams. My parents saved diligently and built a home. They raised 3 girls. Dad had 2 jobs for a long time so he could give us special things, modest vacations, and later on, help us with college tuition. Frugality, born of necessity when he was younger, evolved into a virtue. Dad mowed his own lawn, maintained and repaired our cars, unearthed large rocks in the woods to build stone walls around the property, and even re-roofed the house. No one ever thought of Ed D'Amico as handicapped at all. Doreen D'Amico, Sarasota, Florida, loan officer. Daughter of Edward A. D'Amico, lab technician, 1926 to 1998.
The banker. A dad who decided that freedom meant more than power.
If it hadn't been for my dad, our whole family would still be in Cuba. He was a successful attorney when Fidel Castro declared himself Marxist-Leninist less than a year after taking over. Within 6 months, Dad was offered a cabinet post in the new Castro government. Dad flatly rejected it, although he knew his refusal would mean losing everything he had built over the course of 25 years. He was 50 at the time. One night in the summer of 1960, Dad gathered the family around the dinner table and told us we would be leaving the country immediately. He had my plane ticket ready, and he told me that as the oldest, I was 21, I would leave first, together with my brother-in-law, to establish a beachhead for the family in the United States. Dad, my mother, my two sisters, my younger brother, and my wife would follow as soon as we found a place to live and some means of sustenance. Dad left no room for discussion. He put some $1 and $5 bills on the dining room table, together with toothpaste tubes, small plastic bags, and packs of cigarettes. Then he led us in rolling the bills and squeezing them into the empty toothpaste tubes and cigarettes. We spent 3 days and nights doing this. I don't know what my dad had to do to secure the necessary traveling papers and tickets for the whole family. What I do know is that Dad left behind everything he had built up from a middle-class lifestyle over 3 decades. All our lives, Dad had told us again and again that he would help us get the best education he could possibly provide. He also told us that material wealth might come and go, and that our real inheritance would be our education. When my brother-in-law and I left Cuba, I carried $30 in American money in toothpaste tubes and cigarettes, and, of course, my education. Dad's last words when he took us to the airport were, "Julio, para atrás, ni para tomar impulso." Julio, never take a step back, not even to gather momentum. Dad couldn't practice law in the United States, but that didn't stop him. He went to work for a bank in New York City, making less money than I, his 21-year-old son, who was selling life insurance to make ends meet while going to college at night. Over the course of the next 37 years, Dad, who came over with $50, became president of one of the country's largest banks. His honesty and straightforwardness became legendary in his industry, exactly as it had been in Cuba, which was why Castro had wanted to rub himself with some of Dad's impeccable reputation. During these years, Dad has seen 15 grandchildren and 17 great-grandchildren come to life in America. And we, his children, learned the lesson he so determinedly ingrained in us. Every one of his 15 grandchildren is a college graduate. Julio J. Castellanos, Valencia, California, International Management, retired. Son of Julio J. Castellanos, attorney, 1910.
The reunion. Dads can change. It doesn't happen all that often, but when it does, what a blessing.
I grew up in Florida, and a few years after my parents divorced, my dad moved to Tennessee to remarry. We stayed in touch for a while, and I visited him a few times, but we gradually lost contact with each other. I heard that he had been drinking and was going through some hard times. About 7 years after I had last seen him, I was driving with my young daughter when I nearly hit a man who was crossing the street. I recognized him and turned around, screaming for him to stop. He looked scared, until he recognized me. The initial contact was very uncomfortable, but we shared a hug and set a time to meet the next day. When we met, my father told me that he had been back in Florida for a while, living in a rooming house. Although he didn't say so explicitly, I had the impression that he had been too ashamed to call. I visited with him as much as I could, and the years seemed to melt away, but he was still drinking and had other problems. Unfortunately, I didn't have much time for him. I had a heavy college load and was working full-time as a paramedic, so I urged him to go back to Tennessee, where his sister and other family members could care for him. It took some persuading, but he finally agreed to go. His sister arranged for him to have a complete physical for the first time in years, and my father got himself into a 12-step program. My dad has been sober for 10 years and has spoken for numerous 12-step programs throughout Tennessee. He has beaten prostate cancer and serves on the town board. He spends his time driving people to doctor's appointments and helping out in his community. He has taught me that no matter how bad things get, and whether or not it's your fault, you can bounce back and become a positive influence on yourself, your family, and your community. Tim Arnwine, Pembroke Pines, Florida, business owner, son of Ray Arnwine, community volunteer, 1936.
The Optimist. So many fathers had every reason to be depressed, especially this one.
At 85, my father could have been a poster child for healthy aging. He was avid about his hobbies, read everything he could get his hands on, and jogged 4 miles a day. He and my mother also had an active social life. Then he was diagnosed with malignant melanoma. Despite his age, he instructed his doctors to take all possible measures to prolong his life. Whatever the treatment was, he said, if it would give him more time with his grandchildren, he was willing to undergo it. Shortly after his first surgery, I accompanied him to the hospital for follow-up tests. We were sitting next to each other in a long line of chairs in a noisy corridor, waiting to be called for blood work. We had chatted in the car, but now we were silent. In response to nothing, he said, "You know, I've had a very good life. True, I was in a concentration camp for 5 years and lost my first wife and child, but all in all, I've had a very happy life." What could I say? He did have a happy life, because he believed he did. I put my hand on his, and we waited quietly together. Sharon Samet, New Rochelle, New York, social worker. Daughter of Imre Samet, businessman, 1913 to 1999.
Let me tell you a little bit about him.
My father never preached very much. He just let me watch him lead his life. Mike Hess, son of Bernard Hess.
A few years ago, well before I ever imagined writing a book about Big Russ, I used to pay tribute to him whenever I was asked to give a commencement address. At first, I thought it was impossible to describe in just a few words how important my father was to me. But when I really thought about it, I came up with this. He taught me more by the quiet eloquence of his hard work, by his basic decency, by his intense loyalty. He taught me the true lessons of life. Every time I spoke those words to college graduates and their parents, I could feel a tug, not only in my own heart, but in the collective heart of the audience, which was often expressed by a murmur of appreciation for their fathers. People would come up to me after the speech to say, "You know, that's exactly how I feel about my dad." As I read through the thousands of letters that came in, some of them quite lengthy, from time to time a line or two caught my eye for its power, its beauty, or its originality. These comments may be brief, but they tell us so much about individual fathers and the huge impact they had on their grateful sons and daughters. Whether it's something these fathers said or the way they lived, these are some of the memories, the legacies, and the wisdom they passed on.
My dad taught me to tie my shoes, to cross the street, to get an education, and to believe in my country, my God, and my family. I never had to look far for my hero. He was just across the living room, sitting in his favorite chair, reading the newspaper, and watching the nightly news. Dixie Wilson, daughter of Carl Wilson, Jr., machinist.
Dad was honest. Abe Lincoln, honest. Dave Estow, son of Donald James Estow, plant foreman.
Dad's been gone 3 years now, but I still think of him every day. The way he would laugh at a joke so hard that he'd start to cry, or how, when we were little, he'd get up in the morning, come down for breakfast, and remind us to say good morning to Mr. Sun. All these years later, I finally realized he was the sun. Rebecca Blocker, daughter of Donald Blocker, salesman.
My father embodied a remark by Winston Churchill, "We make a living by what we get, but we make a life by what we give." Christine A. Smith, daughter of Francis D. Smith, detective.
My dad was a rail rider, a risk taker, a joke teller, and a blue-eyed, twinkling package of humor, love, and compassion. Kathy Conaway, daughter of Russell Handstrom, businessman.
My father once told me that by the time he was 7, he had stopped drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. It cracks me up to think he had given up his bad habits by the age of 7. My dad, the infantile delinquent. Judy Casales, daughter of Steve Trubilla, welder.
When I was 19 and an honor student at journalism school, I told my parents I was gay. My father put me in a mental institution. Yes, you could do that back in 1974. He wanted me to be cured, but it didn't work at all, which was quite a shock to Mr. Phi Beta Kappa. 10 years later, the very same man flew 2,000 miles to sit in the front row during opening night of a gay play I had written. He applauded with gusto and was charming and sweet at the cast party. This is what fathers do for us. So many of them will bridge any chasm to connect with us. Jim Bluer, son of Robert Bluer, chemist.
After my divorce, my father advised me to always pay my bills on time to keep my credit good, always have money in the bank, and always wear a bra. Carla Dale, daughter of Mike Foshai, factory supervisor.
Sometimes I find myself offering this prayer, "Please don't let me give up on my son, as my father didn't give up on his." Mike Schachter, son of Irving Schachter, retailer.
A couple of years ago, I called to congratulate my parents on their 53rd wedding anniversary, and I complimented them on how much their marriage has meant to their children. As I was shedding a tear, Dad said, "That's a load of baloney. The deal between your mother and me was that whoever left first had to take all 8 of you." Don Smith, Jr., son of Don Smith, Sr., manufacturing supervisor.
Had my dad lived long enough for me to learn to express myself, I would have loved to let him know how much he meant to me. Al Zussman, son of Benjamin Zussman, sports writer.
He taught me the importance of a solid handshake, the disarming ability of relevant small talk, and the unmistakable effectiveness and success that comes from treating people fairly. Thomas J. McKeever, son of Timothy J. McKeever, manager.
I was never a stepchild, only a loved child. Michelle Thompson, daughter of Peter Mariluch, retired banker.
My father's life would not make chapter 1 of anyone's book, but he taught me how to live by the way he lived. He worked hard, loved his family, had integrity, and wouldn't compromise his values. He wasn't famous, and he didn't have a lot of material things, just character and backbone, society's missing links. Susan W. Jones, daughter of Walter B. Watson, roadmaster.
The year before my father died, I took him to the local 4th of July parade. For many years in the past, he had walked the parade route as a member of a club that supported the celebration. That year, however, we sat on folding lawn chairs and just watched. When the first band approached with flags flying, Dad struggled out of his lawn chair and put his hat over his heart. Then the next band came by, and the same struggle. After the third or fourth band, I had to tell him to just forget it. He was incredulous. This was the flag of his country, he reminded me. How can I not at least stand up? Sandra Johann, daughter of Elmer DeFazio, dentist.
I was my father's princess. Growing up in a rural area of the Deep South could have been a harsh experience for a little black girl, but I was insulated by his love and tenderness. Glenda Boyd, daughter of Donald Starr, educator.
We have an interesting dynamic, my pop and I. I call him a greedy and heartless SOB, and he calls me a commie, socialist, knee-jerk, pinko-liberal. These are terms of endearment in our family. We have completely opposite views of the world, but his guidance and openness about life have led me to form my own views and helped shape the woman I am and will become. I find myself speaking often of my father to people who don't know him, as if in order to understand me, they need to know about him. Frances Boyes, daughter of Michael Boyes, bagel shop owner.
You can't legislate profound and intrinsic decency and integrity, but you can encourage it. And, as I've been fortunate enough to observe by watching my father, you can exemplify it. Thomas D. Lefevre, son of David A. Lefevre, chemical engineer.
I grew in stature simply by standing near my dad, Burton Yalowich, son of Reuben Yalowich, pharmacist.
My father was one of those special people who come along in life who make you feel better just by being there. Tom Akers, son of Ray Akers Sr., funeral director.
Good morning, Dad. How are you today? I'm alive, and that's enough. Rosie Rodriguez, daughter of Raul Rodriguez, plant manager.
My dad always taught us that nobody is better than you are, and you aren't better than anyone else. Michelle Licata Gallo, daughter of Julio A. Licata, drugstore clerk.
He has always been my gentle critic and my biggest fan. Randall Adams, son of Woodrow Adams, coal miner.
My father valued a discount or a sale almost as much as his religion. When he passed, I wanted to put on his tombstone, "I did not bargain for this." Sadly, but perhaps wisely, my family vetoed the suggestion. But he would have loved it. Peter Cove, son of Sam Cove, salesman.
At my father's funeral, the minister said, "Jack Kendall didn't wear his heart on his sleeve because his sleeve wasn't big enough." Brad Kendall, son of Jack Kendall, banker.
My dad was hard of hearing and didn't like using his hearing aids. When I was in high school, I said, "Dad, can you give me $5? He said, "What? I didn't hear you." "I need $10. "Be quiet," he said. "I heard you the first time." What goes around comes around. I find that I, too, have developed selective hearing loss. Lloyd Bergener, son of Lloyd Bergener, farmer.
Pop was dependable, and he expected the same from me. He would often say, "People are counting on you," which was his way of encouraging both timeliness and honesty. Dwayne V. Ackerman, son of Dallas G. Ackerman, plant manager.
He was always able to make the hard times easier and the good times better. Robert Baker, son of Dave Baker, farmer.
My father cut hair 6 days a week for 45 years. That's all he ever did and all he ever knew. He provided for my mom, my three brothers, and me by saying, "How short do you want it?" Michael Caruso, son of Nicholas Caruso, barber.
It seems that some people are destined to sacrifice more than they ever receive in return, and all we can do is wonder at their generosity. Brian Plakas Cheng, son of Constantine N. Plakas, telecom executive.
My father worked hard and saw that as his mission. He brought home the bacon, and every slice counted. Dorothy Nelson, daughter of E.H. Peterson, retail manager.
Whenever I called him, I would say, "Hi, Dad, this is Kathy." And he would respond, "Kathy who? Kathy, your daughter? Which one? Your one and only? Oh, that one." No matter what he was doing, we always had this banter. It made me feel special because he didn't care who was listening or how important they were. I was more important. Kathy Decker, daughter of Robert M. Hurley, architect.
There has never been a man who worked so hard for so long and ended up with so little as my dad. Felicia J. Swisher, daughter of Frederick G. Sullivan, home construction.
If my father were alive, I would want to thank him for not reminding me of the arrogance and narcissism that I exhibited during my college years. Isn't it interesting how much smarter our fathers become after we have finished our formal education? Robert Vogel, son of Vernon Vogel, electrical engineer.
Dad was diagnosed with cancer in 1981, and he waged a war that I was sure he would win. During the 4 years that he lived with cancer, he traveled with Mom, saw three of his children get married, and welcomed several grandchildren. He was a strong man who didn't like to ask for help, which led one of the priests in our parish to remind Dad we're supposed to imitate Christ, not outdo him. Donna Pizzolongo, daughter of George E. Raboni Sr., attorney.
My father would fantasize about winning millions in the lottery and would sit down and make a list of every person he would give it away to. He always left himself out. My mom would say, "Harry, what about us?" And he would answer, "Mary, we don't need anything. We have our house paid off, plenty of food on the table, and we don't owe anybody any money. What more could we want?" Linda Reviel, daughter of Harry Reviel, sanitation worker.
Father knows best.
When I was a boy, my father was boss. Now that I'm a dad, my son is boss. When do I get to be boss? William H. J. Murray, father of William J. Murray.
Like many fathers, my dad has a few favorite expressions. When I was a boy and he thought I was overly impressed with myself, he would say, "Don't get too big for your britches." At a restaurant, he would ask the waitress for the check by saying, "What's the damage?" At supper, he would sometimes tell us, "What you hear at this table stays at this table," although I can't remember any real secrets ever being disclosed. But his favorite expression has always been, "What a country." It means so many things. How fortunate we are. What a great hot dog this is. How much opportunity and upward mobility America provides. And quite literally, what a great country we live in. In my previous book, I quoted another of Big Russ's favorite expressions, "You gotta eat." As soon as the book was published, he called to tell me that I had it wrong. "I got that from Dr. Maddie Burke," he told me, "but she forgot the second part. You gotta eat if you're gonna drink." No matter how many conversations we have with our dads, they often boil down to a few choice words that seem to define him, or a single line that etches itself into our memory. Some of these sayings are original. Others have a time-honored history. But to the sons and daughters who remember these words, they will always belong to their dads.
The only place where success comes before work is in the dictionary. Herman Shays, coach, hospital aide.
Do what you have to do first, and what you want to do second. Donald Jarvis, shop supervisor.
Be a good listener. Sometimes, when you just sit and listen, the other person will answer his own question and will thank you for your help. Russell Fogelsong, sales.
Go for broke. What's the worst that can happen? If they say no, you're right back where you started. And they might say yes. Ray Hassan, TV producer.
Get to know and show respect for clerks and secretaries because they are the gatekeepers. Donald McCarthy, attorney.
Don't let other people's actions govern yours. Gene Smith, railroad yardmaster.
If you ever get taken to jail, don't waste your one phone call calling home. James W. George, Chef.
Save your employer enough money to cover your salary each year. Harold Robert Chataway, computer programmer.
What you are to be, you are now becoming. Russell Lester Snyder, artist.
Choose good friends. If you walk past garbage, you will smell like garbage. Emilio Saporito, dye house worker.
Nobody ever paid me not to go to work. Homer Morrissey, farmer.
Don't brag. It's not the whistle that pulls the train. Nat Landau, insurance salesman.
Procrastination is the thief of time. George F. Newell, educator.
Never replace just one spark plug. Lester William Dreyer, steam fitter.
The fruit you reach for is better than the fruit that falls at your feet. Clyde Smith, transportation operator.
Drive with care. Life has no spare. Bernard Gottlieb, businessman.
You've never gone so far down the wrong road that you can't turn around. David A. Lefevre, chemical engineer.
If you work with your hands, you will never go hungry. Salvatore N. Geraci, chef.
If you can't combine business with pleasure, go out of business. Norman C. Clark, foreman.
Son, do you see those betting windows? Look at how many of them sell tickets and how many cash out tickets for the winners. What does that tell you? Harry Mazur, businessman.
Practice hard. You'll play the way you practiced. Nick Cosmos, coach.
When a young son saw Sophia Loren on TV and asked his father why he hadn't married her, because I met your mother first. James Donald Curry, farmer.
If I can just have enough money to educate my kids with enough left to bury me when I die, I will be a happy man. George Razor, railroad repairman.
Life is a succession of freshman years. Gene Clark Calhorn, business owner.
If you're going to hoot with the owls, you have to soar with the eagles. Harry F. Kelly, Jr., public relations.
A clear conscience is a soft pillow. Harry David LaVenture, shirt cutter.
We can't all be lighthouses. Some of us have to be candles. Harry Geller, barber.
Be grateful that I'm still yelling at you, because that means I still care. When I don't say anything, that's when you should worry. William Pramberger, financial analyst.
We are often broke, but we have never been poor. Joseph Keith Miller, shoe salesman.
If you got something you didn't work for, then someone else worked for something they didn't get. Joe Dan Prado, banker.
You can never be perfect, but the harder you try, the closer you'll come. John Valentin Barshak, salesman.
If you could buy him for what he knows and sell him for what he thinks he knows, you'd turn quite a profit. Marcus L. Bement, paint mixer.
The title of boyfriend means nothing in this house. Richard J. Quigley, IT executive.
Don't be so heavenly-minded that you're no earthly good. Dallas G. Ackerman, plant manager.
You'd be amazed what you can do when you have to. James Joseph Vaughn, operating engineer.
A lucky man gets up in the morning, knows what he has to do, and thinks it still matters. Joe Biden, Sr., salesman.
If things get tight and you can't pay both your car loan and your mortgage, be sure to pay the car loan first. You can live in your car, but you can't drive your house. Frank Pinella, Carpenter.
Don't ruin a holiday. You can always fight tomorrow. Once the holiday is gone, you can't get it back. George E. Raboni, Sr., Attorney.
A laboring man's rest is sweet, and I always slept well. James E. Hill, Street Sweeper, Truck Driver.
Epilogue. I will always be here for you. We are bonded by blood. Tim Russert, son of Tim, Big Russ Russert, father of Luke Russert. Sometimes the hardest part of being a father are the things you can't say. In the early fall of 2004, as Luke prepared to go off to college, I was excited for him. My own college experience had been deeply satisfying. I loved my new independence, enjoyed my courses, made new friends, and became head of a club that brought a number of big-name rock groups to campus. Now Luke would have his own chance to grow more independent and pursue his passion for living and, I hope, learning. But as the day grew closer when Maureen and I would take him to college, I became increasingly sad. Luke was my son, and I would miss having him home. But he also was my friend and my companion, and I would miss him in those roles as well. We had gone to countless ball games together, and on Sunday afternoons during the football season, he would usually join me on the couch to watch the Buffalo Bills on satellite TV. How could I ever get used to not having him there? Ever since he had learned to drive, he had become increasingly independent. But even then, he still lived with us, and there was always the comfort of knowing that he was upstairs sleeping, that he was around. I knew his going to college didn't mean the end of our relationship. He would come home from time to time, and we could talk on the phone and on email, and Maureen and I would soon be going back to Boston for parents' weekend. But my heart was aching over his imminent absence. When departure day arrived, the three of us flew to Boston. We took Luke to his dorm room and helped set it up. Then, when there was nothing left to do, Maureen and I just stood there, both of us unwilling to leave. Luke thanked us for everything and gently suggested that it was time to say goodbye. We each gave him a hug. I hesitated, wondering if I should give him a letter I had written. But instead, I hugged him again and slipped him a couple of 20s. A moment after we left, I went back in and handed him an envelope. "Here," I said, "I want you to have this." "What is it?" "Read it when I leave." No, wait. I'll read it now." "Dear Luke, off you go. New school, new city, new friends, new challenges. You are more than ready. Whether it was New York or Washington, West Side Montessori, St. Columbus, Bovar, or St. Albans, you connected with people and made your mark. I've so enjoyed watching and helping you grow. We've had an amazing 19 years together. I hope we have at least another 19. I will always be here for you. We are bonded by blood. Call anytime, any day, with good news or bad. I am on your side. Keep an open mind to new ideas and people with different views. Study hard. Laugh often. Keep your honor. With admiration, respect, and deep love, Dad, aka Big Guy." When Luke finished reading the letter, he put it back in the envelope. I reached out to take it back, but he said, "No, that's mine now." The next few days were very difficult. There were many times when I just wanted to pick up the phone and call him, but I didn't want to embarrass him with his new friends or burden him with my loneliness. On the phone, Big Russ could hear in my voice that I wasn't myself. "What's wrong?" he asked. "I miss Luke so much," I said. "You know, it's just as tough on him," Dad told me. "Are you kidding? He's having the time of his life." That's what I thought, but a year later, Luke told me that Big Russ had been right. That first semester was really tough, he said. But I knew I couldn't say anything because you would have wanted to come up, and that wouldn't have been good for either of us. The wisdom of my father, spoken by my son.
We hope you have enjoyed this production of Wisdom of Our Fathers, Lessons and Letters from Daughters and Sons by Tim Russert. This program was produced by Jacob Bronstein and Kevin Thompson and directed by Tony Huds and Kevin Thompson. Published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Inc. Text copyright 2006 by Tim Russert. Production copyright 2006, Books on Tape.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.